Welcome to the Middletown Podcast. My name is Fiona McCaffrey, and today I'll be talking mindfulness with Dr. Brian McLean. Dr. Brian McLean qualified as a clinical psychologist from the University of Surrey in 1989, and over 30 years he has helped develop more than 1,000 multi-element behaviour support plans. He currently works with Acquired Brain Injury Ireland in the Irish Midlands, whose mission is to enable people with neuro-rehabilitation needs to live the lives of their choosing. He lectures in clinical psychology at University College Dublin and in applied behaviour analysis at NUI Galway. Brian, you're very welcome and thank you for agreeing to do this with us today.
Thank you very much, Fiona. It's good to be here.
Brian has already provided a webinar for Middletown Centre on the subject of mindfulness, and that was provided to us on the 16th of June. But we're all still, I feel, Brian, still recovering from the trauma, really, of lockdown and the very unexpected turn of events that happened to us in 2020.
I think so. I think we're still at the kind of early stages of it. I don't think we're even at half time. Somebody said we're just after having the first round. It's been quite a mixed bag. I know for some families and for some people with autistic spectrum disorders, it's been a period of kind of calm and quiet and not too much change and disruption. And some people have really appreciated that, actually. But I know for many people, it's been a time of really missing services and missing routine and regularity and supports. And I know for some families, it's been really, really difficult.
So your whole approach to mindfulness is very timely at the moment, Brian, as people are seeking ways to regulate themselves and regulate those around them. So I just want to pick up on some of the broad themes you addressed in your webinar, Brian. You talk about the 5 steps to supporting a person who may be distressed. And that would be building a low arousal of environment, building rapport, using predictability and engagement, communication and incentive. Would you please expand on these a little bit and provide some examples of how these steps might be taken?
Sure, Fiona. I mean, for me, I think that what makes sense is that we should be in a low state of arousal in order to be able to relate to others and to learn. It just makes sense to me that there's no point in starting anywhere else if I'm in a high state of arousal. If I can't find a kind of a place of sanctuary and gather myself. And so I suppose my first step in trying to support somebody in distress is really to figure out, you know, what is this person's level of arousal like? And does this person kind of have self-soothing skills, or is there a way that the environment can support a person to get to a point of calm so that the person can notice me or notice others, and so that the person can begin to build rapport and figure out what's expected of them? All of that requires that the fight or flight system isn't in overdrive, if you like. So sometimes creating a kind of a low arousal environment is very obvious things like reducing the amount of noise, reducing the amount of language, allowing silence, speaking slowly, supporting our words with pictures. And just, I think our whole demeanor can convey a sense of calm. Sometimes that's important for people in distress. I think in Ireland, we find that quite difficult. We're inclined, I think, culturally to fill the silences with talk. We kind of don't want the awkwardness of nothing happening for a while. And I think the great phrase that goes with mindfulness is, don't just do something, sit there, which is the kind of counterintuitive, you know, because we're kind of told not to be idle and we should be doing something. So allowing silence can give kind of time to gather ourselves. I work with people with acquired brain injury, and people can give me very clear first-hand accounts of what it's like to be overstimulated, what it's like to be in kind of high arousal. People will describe it as a nightmare sometimes to have to go shopping in a busy supermarket with the kind of sensory bombardment, or sitting into a conversation where other people are talking their pace. People find it very difficult to keep up. Words seem to fly by like bullets, and people can feel very disempowered, I suppose. So speed of processing is one of the things that can be affected. And the environment can accommodate that by slowing down at least sometimes, by allowing space and allowing breaks. So that's kind of what I mean by a low arousal environment. It's probably saying less sometimes. The second thing then that I think is crucial is that we use that time to build rapport. For many people who are in great stress, the people around the person can feel like obstacles rather than supporters. I think it's very important, particularly when there's a diagnosis of ASD, that the environment takes time to establish that it's the people around the person that are important. And I think that as support people, we're only as good as the rapport that we can build. So what do I mean by rapport building? I think all of us intuitively build rapport. If we imagine a parent who's never had a child before bringing home a baby from the hospital, the baby is kind of an all sleeping, all crying, all feeding machine. When the parent gets up in the middle of the night and meets that child, unless the parent is really, really tired, that parent will do certain things intuitively. That parent will intensely follow the gaze and the lead of the infant. So that if the infant looks away and looks at the light, a parent will notice that without any prior instruction and will follow the gaze of the infant and then name what it is that the infant is doing and wait for a response from that infant. And if the infant looks back, the parent will kind of interpret or almost over-interpret that response as a social connection. And we'll celebrate that more than any other thing that the baby does. So it's almost like the parent is primed to receive even the most fragile notes of social connectedness on the part of the infant. And that's how I think we can be when we're trying to build rapport with somebody who has ASD and is struggling. We can kind of prime ourselves to pick up on any signal, however weak, and kind of build on that by interpreting it or even over-interpreting it, putting a message or a name on top of it, and then waiting to see if the person responds. Does that make sense, do you think, Fiona?
It absolutely does. And yeah, the analogy of the child is actually a very useful one, because we are quite finely tuned to trying to catch and to capture and expand on attention that we get from children. So yeah. I like that idea quite a lot.
I think as babies grow into older ones, we tend to have more of our own agenda. So we kind of think that the child or even the adult, you know, should do this and must do this. And the parent with the infant has an agenda as well. The nappy needs to be changed, but And we're building rapport and looking for opportunities to build rapport in every moment. And I just think that, maybe we need to start rebuilding rapport every day. I know many people that I can build rapport with, but I start anew every time I meet. I'm only as good as the rapport I can build, you know. And if I'm connecting with the person, if the person sees I have some significance for them in that moment, then I can start to set out an agenda and say, look, first we'll do this and then we'll do this. But
and then that kind of leads you into this idea of using predictability in that engagement.
Yeah, and we tend to think, especially as teachers, we tend to think of predictability in terms of, you know, representing pictorially the map for time. So first we'll do this and then we'll do this and then we'll do this. And that's lovely. That's a great way of helping people see what we mean. But we can build predictability with ritual and routine. One of the greatest, what would you say, innovators of predictability that I knew was a teacher I worked with once. He would meet each student at the door. He would only leave the door, you know, a little bit open so that only one student could get in at a time. And so each student had a greeting ritual where the teacher kind of high-fived or fist-bumped each student as he or she came in the door. And it was an opportunity for the teacher to just check in for a moment with each pupil. But that kind of greeting ritual sort of set the occasion for the class, that the teacher was establishing his social significance. But also it was kind of saying, playground time is over. We're marking the entry into a new time and a new set of expectations with a ritual. And I think that kind of predictability can be helpful as well. And then, of course, routine. I mean, routines are things where We tend, you know, the body knows what to do. If we have routines in the day where we do the same thing in the same sequence, we don't have to think or worry or give cognitive effort to what's happening next. And that kind of freewheeling can be really helpful. Some people describe the cognitive effort people with the ASD sometimes have to make as like cycling up a hill. You know, when you're cycling up a hill and it's hard and it's tough and you're looking at the top of the hill and kind of wishing it to come to you, because when you get to the top of the hill, you'll be able to freewheel for a while and it won't be quite so much effort. And I think routine for many people with ASD is a little bit like, you know, finally arriving at the downhill where you can freewheel and you don't have to make the cognitive effort of wondering, what have I got to do here and what's this person expecting of me? And that can be really nice as a kind of a regular part of the day.
And very regulating as well for some children and young people. You know, concept of freewheeling is a great opportunity to gain emotional regulation.
Yeah, absolutely. I know so many really, really good teachers who think, well, I have the student in the class now and I'm in rapport, so I need to use every minute of that time, you know. I need to help the student catch up with any time that's been lost. And so I'm going to work this child until 3 o'clock. And really, you know, many children will learn far better with very regular breaks of freewheeling and then come back fresh. So I think that's a great kind of tool to use if we can. And I think it's only when there's low arousal, there's rapport, and the child has a sense of predictability, that teaching actually becomes meaningful. I think these are the three preconditions for effective teaching, actually. So when there's low arousal and rapport and predictability, then I think a child or an adult can learn. And so it's at that point that it makes sense to me to try and teach the person an alternative way of communicating. And then and only then, when the skill is being learned, does it make sense for me to motivate the person to get it right rather than get it wrong. And so I suppose this five-step idea is kind of turning on its head an old idea from behavior management that said, look, if you want to change behavior, you've got to figure out the rewards and the consequences, the triggers and the consequences. No, I don't think so. I think you've got to know that the person is in sufficiently low arousal, in good rapport, has a sense of predictability, has a sense of what to expect and a map for time, can get it right. And then I think we can start messing around with incentives and reward contracts. So that's the kind of the point, Fiona, of that sort of 5-point starting steps in behavioural support, if you like.
You use the quote, mindfulness allows us to see our reactions building. Could you explain a little bit about that?
So mindfulness is, there's a couple of kind of ways into mindfulness, if you like. Mindfulness is a way of giving attention. It's a way of paying attention. And a great way to start is to start to pay attention to what's going on around us, to use the senses. I remember one amazing guy I worked with a diagnosis of ASD. He was nonverbal and his body was in a kind of a constant state of high arousal, and he would bound from floor to ceiling, using up huge amounts of energy and whoop while he was doing it. But every now and again, he would go and get a cloth. And he would put on the tap and he'd fill the cloth with water, and then he'd wring the cloth out and watch the drops as they came from the cloth. And as he did that, you could just see his body kind of coming into calm, because he was directing his attention, I suppose, out onto the world and out onto something that just calmed him and slowed him down. So that was mindfulness. That was paying attention. And one of what we needed to do, I think, was make sure he had access to that activity and other activities like it that brought him to a kind of a calmer place. So that's attending. The thing is that we can actually start to attend to what's going on in the body as well. And it can be really helpful if somebody kind of directs us to that. So what's happening in the tummy right now? What's happening in the heart right now? What's happening in the throat right now? We can start to tune into the physical sensations inside. And one of the great innovations in mindfulness for people with intellectual disabilities has been the work of Norbay Singh, whose idea is a meditation on the soles of the feet. in helping people with problems associated with aggressive behavior to redirect their attention to the physical sensations in the sole of the foot as a way of kind of grounding and calming person and allowing a little space so as to make a choice. Now, that's kind of paying attention to physical sensation. We can also pay attention to what's happening at the level of feeling, even just noticing whether my breathing is fast or slow, noticing whether there are areas of comfort or areas of discomfort. These are ways of starting to figure out what's happening to the weather pattern inside at the level of mood or feeling. And we can also learn to tune in at the level of thoughts and figure out what thoughts are there. And one way we do this is to kind of ask people to focus on the breath, particularly because kind of noticing the breath isn't a very exciting thing to have to do. So the mind will naturally wander. And with a little gentle guidance, people can learn to identify that the mind has wandered, that there is thinking, and then to register that thinking and bring the attention back to the breath. And this practice, I think, really, really helpful. This business of returning attention from thought, acknowledging that I'm having the thought that this is going well, or I'm having the thought that this is tricky, but I can bring my attention back to the here and now. Rather than get lost in that thought, and rather than get hijacked by that feeling, if you know what I mean. So that business of mindfulness is about starting to expand an awareness about what's happening at the level of body and feeling and thought, and learning to return attention to where I want it to be. And then I think that the last stage of mindfulness is to learn to accept whatever it is that I'm attending to as just as it is for now. In other words, it's very cloudy out at the moment as I look out on it, and I kind of might find myself wishing it to be other. And the point is that I can wish like that for hours. I could wish like that intently. I could struggle and struggle against the way things are, but it's not going to change things. And in fact, a lot of that struggle and wishing things were other than the way they are, a lot of that is distress. A lot of that is unhappiness. And I just don't need to do that. Things go a lot easier for me if I accept that things aren't perfect, but they are just as they are for now. That can take a little practice too. It can take a little kind of awareness that a lot of my attention in the world is kind of judging and deciding what's good and what's not good. But I don't get to write the script for life, so I shouldn't really waste so much energy trying to change it.
In your session with us, you detailed some unhelpful cycles of thinking and behaviour. How can we break the cycle of thinking leading into behaviour and the problems that that can result in? And what role might mindfulness play in this?
It can be difficult to break habits on our own. I think one of the things that's most helpful, if we have a kind of supportive person who's kind of with us, who's a good listener, who's not making judgments and decisions of her own about our behaviour and our thoughts and our feelings. I think there are a number of steps. I think the first step on this road is to try and figure out what our triggers are. I think all of us have triggers, things that kind of lead to flare-ups. So for one person, it might be criticism. And for another person, it might be disappointment. And for another person, it might be confusion. And for some of us, it's all of those things. But to know our triggers means that we can start to remove them or reduce them a little bit, or make plans for the next time they're going to arise and be prepared. I think the next step for me is to start to develop, I suppose what I've been talking about for the last 10 or 15 minutes is emotional literacy. And I think one of the aspects of that is getting to know the world of feelings, not to be frightened of them. To get to know, for example, that what's going on at the moment is called sadness, or what's going on at the moment is called anger. And it's perfectly okay. Like a cloud in the sky, it's going to come. It's going to stay a while. Sometimes clouds are a bit slower than others. Sometimes they're dark and foreboding looking. But all of them pass. And so I think emotional literacy is about getting to know the names of the feelings, what they feel like at the start, what the experience of them is in the middle, and the fact that they pass. Another great thing to be able to do is to work with the body. A lot of emotional problems are not resolved with thinking and analyzing. And they're actually resolved by looking at what's happening in the body when I'm having that feeling. So if my tummy feels a little warm or if my heart is beating a little fast, maybe it's about breathing in slow, cool air into that area of the body. And you're kind of giving yourself the message, it'll be all right. You know, that kind of self-soothing is a terrific skill. And then it can be really helpful to examine our thoughts. It's natural for people to think that our thoughts are kind of gospel and written in stone and that there's no other perspective possible. But actually, you know what? There is. We can actually examine a thought and ask ourselves, I wonder, is there any evidence for that? So we kind of take on a role of judge in the court case in the head. And instead of just listening to the prosecution, we sort of ask, is there evidence? Is there another case to be made for an alternative thought? Is that thought actually accurate? And more importantly, is that thought helpful to me? Is there a wise alternative thought available? So, for example, if I have the thought, she doesn't want to talk to me, she doesn't like me because nobody likes me. It's a great skill to be able to say, I wonder, is that thought true? I wonder, is it true that she doesn't like me? I wonder, is it true that nobody likes me? What's the evidence for that? Is there any facts that I can use to back that up? And would those facts stand up in a court of law, or at least in the court case of the head? And I wonder if we ask the prosecution to sit down and ask the defense to stand up for a moment. I wonder, is there any counter evidence? Maybe there's evidence that she does actually like me, but she's just having a tricky day herself and doesn't feel like talking. Or maybe there's evidence that other people like me and I don't have to worry so much about this one relationship. So I wonder what a more balanced court case would sound like. So those are the kinds of things, Fiona.
Thanks for that, Brian. And I'll just finish off by asking you about some of your preferred resources that can promote mindfulness. And if you could consider these across child, teen and adult needs.
So one of the people that I'm a very big fan of, and I've actually never met her, but it's Dervil Dunford up in Westport. And Dervil does training for teachers in mindfulness. She teaches teachers to teach mindfulness to children. And I think this is just such a potentially valuable resource. So Dervil has produced CDs, Mindfulness Matters and The Zone, which I find useful as kind of very creative tracks. Each of them is about 4, 5, 6 minutes that give children as young as 5 guidance in terms of how to listen to the breathing or observe the tummy as it's breathing. And I find them very, very useful. She's also got a lovely mindfulness CD for helping children sleep. She's also got CDs for adults. So I like those resources. Eileen Snell is an American writer who has a resource called Sitting Like a Frog. And the second track of that CD in particular is about 4 or 5 minutes. And it asks children to sit like a frog and to notice the wiggling of the toes or the tendency of the body to move and the breath moving and so on. And it's quite an imaginative way into mindfulness for children, quite a playful way. For adults, many people don't like mindfulness at the start. It's not for everybody. And the idea of sitting still can be anathema to people. And we work a lot with the senses. So simply going for a walk and noticing, you know, the feel of the contact of the sole of the foot against the, and noticing the gentle feeling of the air against the skin and the smells and tastes and sounds and the colors. That's as mindful as anything. We don't need to sit like Buddha in order to achieve a kind of a mindful state. And I suppose the thinker that most aligns with that is a guy called Porik O'Moron. Pádraic is from Dublin, at least I think he has a Dublin accent. He writes for the Irish Times sometimes. But he has written some wonderful books. The first of them was Mindfulness on the Go. I sometimes call it Mindfulness in a Hurry. But the idea is that we don't need to sit and meditate in order to kind of draw out the benefits of mindfulness. I suppose the resources I use most often then would be those of Mark Williams, and particularly the book Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Finding Peace in a Frantic World. And Mark Williams has used mindfulness and researched mindfulness with people with, particularly people with depression, people with very significant mental health problems, and found that mindfulness is of great therapeutic benefit and extremely effective, particularly for the people with the most significant mental health problems. And it not only helps to resolve many significant mental health issues, it actually helps prevent the recurrence of these difficulties. And I just love the simplicity of the approach. I think it's a very profound book, and it comes with a CD with about 8 mindfulness tracks on it. One of them, the last one, is the 3-minute breathing space, which is an exercise that people can learn and apply when we are, you know, driving in a car or queuing in a supermarket or situations that can kind of lead to our flare-ups.
Thank you, Brian, for all of that wonderful insight.
Thank you very much, Fiona.
The Middletown podcast is released every Friday and is available to download from Spotify and from the Centre's website. Next podcast, I will be speaking with Tara Vernon on the subject of sleep and autism.